Get a balanced analysis on both domestic and international topics within the framework of cross-cultural comparisons. This is Dialogue.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue. Speaking at the just concluded Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore, defense ministers from China and the US presented different views and ideas on security in the Asia-Pacific region and how to engage with each other. While the US is doubling down its military presence in this region, will such efforts bring about peace and stability or the opposite? As the US continues with its economic coercive measures, including sanctions on Chinese individuals, is there true intention from Washington to engage with China for a stable and constructive relationship? How will the Chinese security initiative differ from the US security strategy? To find out more, I'm joined today by participant of the summit, Zhou Bo, who is also a senior fellow at the Center for International Strategy and Security of Tsinghua University. That's our topic. I'm Xu Qinduo. Welcome to Dialogue, Senior Colonel Zhou, where you were at the present for the speeches by defense ministers, for example, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. And I wonder what were your takeaways from his speech?
Actually, what he said is not really a big surprise to me, because I have listened to many Secretary of State's speech in the past, as they normally would talk about American values, you know, the importance of partnership, and then they would just outline what they have done, you know, in the last 12 months, for example, you know, in a kind of a country-specific description. And of course, they will always talk about China-US relationship. But in this speech, I think there is one point that has really caught my attention. That is when he said that a conflict between China and the United States is not imminent and it's not inevitable. For me, this is a kind of official denial of what some American general said in the past. For example, that mainland China would launch attack on Taiwan in 2025, 2027, and so on and so forth. Given his authority, I think this kind of a message would carry a lot of weight. And besides, he talked about the importance of having dialogue. Of course, no one can deny the importance of dialogue, but he purposefully evaded, you know, one important aspect, that is the so-called sanction on our defense minister. So he didn't mention that. So it's quite logical. Why we should have a conversation why Chinese defense minister is being sanctioned. And this kind of sanction is ridiculous, because it happened in 2018 when Chinese bought Russian you know, Su-35 and defense missiles S-400. And he was heading armament department at that time. And so it's his decision, but it's also the decision of PLA and the Chinese government. This kind of bilateral trading is not a secret. You know, it was you know, started in 1990s, and it has nothing to do with the United States. So how can you have a sanction on Chinese defense minister? And even his capacity has changed, right? You can argue that well, he was being sanctioned when he was the director of the Armament Development Department, but now he's a Chinese defense minister. Yeah, so if there is an excuse for them to lift the sanction, I would say this is the perfect excuse. Yeah?
Well, good point. You know, of course, the US side blamed the so-called, you know, unwillingness of the Chinese side to engage in dialogues with the US. You know, it make China, you know, look like somehow like irresponsible as a big power. But then the question is like, you know, lifting the sanctions is very easy for Washington if they are truly intentionally to seek dialogue with the Chinese side. Why didn't they do that?
Some people I talk to believe that is not so easy. The reason is the Biden administration is not a very strong administration, and they probably are afraid of losing face. That is a problem for them. You
domestically?
Know? Yeah. Theoretically, it's very easy because it is an executive order. So even the administration can actually lift the sanction. But they say it's not easy to do that. But let me tell you the consequence. The consequence would be very, very serious. Because a Chinese defense minister would have served for 5 years. Just imagine, you know, with this sanction in place, he cannot go to visit the United States. And he can't invite Lord Austin to visit China. And when American military delegations come to visit China, I mean, if they invite you to come to visit China, it's difficult for Chinese minister to meet with the delegation. So the next 5 years would be extremely difficult. Yeah. Plus the South, you know, relationship between the two military. So this is just like a Chinese saying, add the frost to the snow.
Mm-hmm. So there are consequences, and long-term consequences even in the next 5 years. If the U.S., let's say the U.S. administration, you know, there remains lack of courage to face theoretically an easy task, but somehow they succumb to this potential challenge and then keep the sanctions on. So that's probably a demonstration of irresponsibility of Washington in that sense, you know, for the two big powers. But anyway, you know, coming back to his speech, you know, he talked about basically he touted, you know, the U.S. success of leadership building by having AUKUS with Australia, with the U.K. Some would call that a military alliance, and then Quad, the security framework with Japan, Australia, India, for example, and of course, four more military bases in the Philippines, numerous military exercises in this region. But you know, he presented that as efforts to maintain peace and stability. But there is a worry that that may, you know, divide, destabilize, or even militarize this region. I wonder what's your take?
I don't think he's actually portraying the right picture. Because if we talk about the situation globally, you would find that actually in Global South, there is a very few chance of the United States winning over China, especially in Africa and in Latin America. Yeah, because the Chinese economic activities are ubiquitous. Yeah, Americans talk, but they cannot deliver. And then we come to the Indo-Pacific. In the Indo-Pacific, it's not a black and white picture, but I believe I'm right to say that very few countries wish to take sides. And it's not easy even for American allies to take sides, yeah, wholeheartedly or blindly, yeah, with the United States, because China is the largest trading partners. So this would be very, very difficult for them, yeah, to make a choice as well. Yeah, so for example, Japan has a legal responsibility of providing logistic support to the U.S. military should they be involved in a conflict in Taiwan Strait. But just imagine how difficult it must be for Japan, right? Because they would worry about their own security, and they would worry about the Diaoyu Islands, or probably it's more than Diaoyu Islands, because if they are involved in a war even with China, so think about the consequences. So the United States definitely is trying to gang up with allies in an effort to counter China. The question is, I don't believe they would be very successful, because if you look at the strategy, such as the Indo-Pacific strategy, they have a lot of purposes. But they don't have enough tools. So it's just a kind of propaganda, I believe.
You know, also there's, I guess it's a routine accusation or so-called criticism about, you know, in his term, like coercion and bullying, basically in the South China Sea, in the so-called international space, the Chinese efforts against the U.S., closing surveillance, you know, either by the, let's say, spy plane or this military vessel very close to Chinese territory, basically looking into the Chinese territory, collecting information. How do you respond to this kind of accusation? Somehow they blame the Chinese intercepts of their planes.
I think I know more than many other people on this issue about the legal implication of freedom of navigation, because I headed Chinese delegation to Pentagon to have bilateral talks on the legal implication of freedom of navigation. And I always point out that it's not that China is right and the U.S. is wrong. It is because the U.N. Convention of the Law of the Sea is actually a product of 9 years negotiation, the longest in human history. So for people to negotiate on this treaty, there are actually a lot of ambiguities, deliberate ambiguity for all people to agree on, so people can agree on it. I just give example, Article 58. Article 58, in the first paragraph, it says that all countries have this kind of rights of freedom of navigation and overflight. But even in the same article, in paragraph 3, it says that in so doing, the country that does this have to pay due regard to the rights and interests of the littoral states. So then, you see, we're talking about the two sides of the same coin, yeah. Even within the same article. So then China can safely argue, okay, where is your due regard if you send ships and aircraft for closing reconnaissance and surveillance of more than 2,000 or 3,000 times in a year, right? And talking about freedom of navigation, there is one, you know, disadvantage on the American side, which they can hardly deny. That is, they haven't ratified the UN Convention Law of the Sea. So there comes this question. If the law is so good, why don't you ratify it? Then if the law is not so good, why would you challenge others in the name of this law? I ask this question, yeah? Nobody can answer this question.
Hard to answer.
Yeah, yeah. You just tell me, yeah? If it is good, why don't you ratify it? If it's not good, why would you challenge others in the name of it? And who gives you the right to challenge others? Yeah? If every year, the U.S. Navy would challenge, you know, the so-called excessive claims of about 20 to 21 countries. And they say, okay, we even challenge our allies. As if, okay, they are very much impartial, right? But who gives you this right? Yeah? And people could have their own reservation for certain articles in the law. For example, China and India have a reservation for the same article, that is Article 298. Yeah, so sometimes you would hear Indians talking about free and open Indo-Pacific as if they were just on the side of the United States. No, if you just read the law, the domestic law, their law is much more strict, yeah, even than China's law. Yeah, because when it comes to exclusive economic zone, China does talk about security, but they only mention security in such a general way. But for India, yeah, they have made it quite clear, if you do military exercise in the exclusive economic zone, you have to seek the consent of the Indian government if it involves ammunition and explosives.
Well, if you have to sum up, you know, the U.S. Indo-Pacific or Asia-Pacific strategy, it seems people see what they are doing is really to reinforce alliances or building new alliances here, military ones, mm-hmm. in this region. Mm-hmm. I mean, the target is there's only one country, that's China, in a sense, like anti-China probably efforts.
Yeah.
They present it as, you know, efforts for peace and stability. But the Chinese side would see that, you know, attempts that could divide the region.
Mm.
I mean, how likely is it, you know, or what kind of damage it might do?
I think, first of all, it is right that the United States wants to be focused on the Indo-Pacific. But this war in Ukraine turned out to be a distraction, right? Because Biden even talked about China as a reason why the U.S. troops have to pull out from Afghanistan. So Americans' intention is crystal clear. Yeah, it's focused on China. And if it can, it will just rally the allies or even partners against China. There's no doubt about that, yeah, no matter what they say. But the only question is how capable, yeah, is the United States, yeah, in doing that? Because, you know, the war in Ukraine certainly has siphoned a lot of the efforts, the resources, and nobody knows how long this war will last, right? And but even if the war stops one day, because no war will last forever, and the U.S. might be refocused again in the Indo-Pacific. But again, as I mentioned, no countries want to pick side. So I believe this kind of a competition between China and the U.S. if there is a competition, is first of all to see who actually make less mistakes, and then to see who can win over third parties. Yeah, and there is no guarantee that the U.S. would have more friends than China. Yeah.
Speak of the competition between the U.S. And China. Of course, the Chinese defense minister has a speech on China's new security initiatives. For viewers outside China, how do you characterize the Chinese security concept or the new security initiatives?
Chinese President Xi Jinping has put forward the global security initiative. And what is it all about? I believe, I think the idea is that the world has changed. Therefore, we must look at the world with a kind of new perspective. And then what is new in China's new perspective or global security initiative? Then action speaks louder than words. If you look at the PLA's operation overseas, you would conclude they are all humanitarian in nature, be it peacekeeping, counterparacy, or disaster relief. They are humanitarian in nature. And you just cannot give me an example over in the last 4 decades that PLA has even killed even one foreigner overseas. You can't give an example. And how many people have died in the war launched by the United States, be it their enemies or even innocent civilians? How many wars and how many people have actually suffered from this war? So this is what I actually hope for the Chinese PLA. Because China's rise is peaceful. Nobody can disagree with that. This is a miracle in human history. In the last 40 years and more, apart from 4 Chinese soldiers and 20 Indian soldiers who died in a deadly brawl in Himalaya mountains, so there are no other casualties. This is a miracle for a rising power. Yeah? And even in that kind of deadly brawl, the two sides know they should not shoot at each other. We were not shooting at each other. So I believe since China's rise is peaceful, is a miracle, I hope China can set a good example in days to come. And this is how Chinese PLA has been doing. Yeah, apart from all those what I have mentioned, PLA hospital ship has been sailing around the world to provide free medicine and free medical treatment to the local people. And why would they do that? And I believe they are doing that in a kind of emulation of what Admiral Zheng He did during Ming Dynasty. Because when he sailed in the Indian Ocean, he was remembered. He was remembered of giving away porcelain and silk, in exchange of some local gifts. So yes, he did use force sometimes, but he was most remembered to be a general. Yeah, that is that is very much mild, Pacific, and that is the image of China in Ming Dynasty. So today, I believe China also wants to project this image, and that tells why China is so dedicated to such things like peacekeeping. Yeah. Peacekeeping basically is the work of a good Samaritan. It's meant to help other people, in need, because the world will never be, out of wars. There are always some people suffering somewhere, and so this is how PLA is doing. So if we look at the PLA's future, I said, the motto of PLA is to serve the people. Yeah, this is all what Chinese people know. But in 21st century, who is the people? It's not only Chinese people, it's also people of the world.
People of the world. If this is the ultimate goal or even purpose of the Chinese military, and then what is the Chinese vision of security in the Asia-Pacific region or worldwide?
The world actually is become more divided. That is true, because we have a war going on, right? In Europe, this is a hot war. So after this hot war, what will have happen? I believe a cold war will just happen. Yeah, then we are going to have a cold war. Why do I say that? Because I believe what is the outcome of this war in Ukraine? I believe probably we are going to see an armistice like we have seen in the Korean Peninsula. But this one is more unstable because with Russia on one side, which is much more powerful, with Ukraine on the other side, however supported by NATO, so this is difficult to maintain. Then in the Indo-Pacific, that is characterized with this kind of a competition between China and the United States. When I talk about competition, I actually have some hesitation because China have been talking about cooperation, right? So, but of course, in major power relationship, there is always an element of competition and cooperation. The final question is, are we going to have another war, be it in the South China Sea or in Taiwan Strait? I believe actually in South China Sea, it is more dangerous. Why? Because American ships and aircraft keep coming, yeah? So there are indeed dangers of getting too close to each other, to trigger an accident, yeah? Because it's not that we want them to come, but even if we don't want them to come, they still would want to come. So that is why we had the deadly collision in 2001, and actually there are so many standoffs at sea, or close encounters in air. Yeah, we read the news from time to time. But in Taiwan Strait, I believe mainland China really has patience. We still have patience. In this regard, I'm happy. Yeah, Secretary Austin said, a conflict is not inevitable, is not imminent, yeah? Because why? Because peace also serves the interest of mainland China. What I'm saying is not rhetorical. Look at China's defense budget. China's defense budget after the war in Ukraine, twice, in 2 years, are still, just like in decades, below 2%. Defense budget is a good indicator because it won't lie, because it tells how you think about your rival, your environment, or how you think about yourself. So it's the best indicator, of your assessment of the situation. So this year, China's GDP is still less than 2%. You know, it's such a sharp contrast with the sudden rise of defense expansion of Japan, for example, right? That tells a lot.
Mm-hmm. Lord Austin also talked about, quote, deterrence is strong today, and it's our job to keep it that way. I wonder how does the Chinese military respond to that, is there a combat readiness for the PLA if there's external forces supporting the secessionist forces in Taiwan and the Chinese side is ready to prevent or stop such behavior?
Well, in our law of anti-secession, there are actually clearly indicated the three scenarios in which non-peaceful means have to be applied. Yeah, the first is Taiwan declaring independence, right? The second one is the occurrence of some incidents leading to the separation of Taiwan, which I believe is referring to the interference of external forces. The third situation is that this issue has actually lost all prospect of reality. So mainland China believes that all possible means for peaceful reunifications are exhausted. So this is what I have always been arguing, to let peace prevail in the Taiwan Strait, you have to let the mainland China to believe, there is still a way of realizing reunification. That is a peaceful reunification. If mainland believe, okay, it is still possible, then we won't use force. And that is why we insist that this is only the last resort, right? So, of course, PLA will do hard training because when we talk about peaceful reunification, we have to prepare for the worst. And the worst is most probably Americans would be involved and the allies would be involved in one way or another. So therefore, this kind of involvement is taken into account by PLA. Yeah. So we don't hope we will have to fight against them, but this is a reality. So that is why we have to become modernized and we have to become world-class military, and that explains why we are just having more and more exercises, you know, among the services. So we want to become strong, but we are not doing this with a big military expenditure. Yeah, so I think we're just doing it in a slow and steady way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for speaking with us.
From Liang Jiahe, a village on the barren Loess Plateau in northwest China, to Zhongnanhai, the center of China's top leadership in Beijing. Xi Jinping has served in various posts at different levels of the government across China, starting in his early years as a junior village official to governing as China's top leader. What's he like as an individual and as a leader? How have his work experiences from earlier decades been influencing his leadership as the national leader? What are some of the core principles that have guided his decisions and actions?
I consider myself a relatively hard-working person. I know very well that people's biggest concerns are education, employment, income.
We
can't pursue development through destructive methods, depleting the legacies from our ancestors while exhausting the options for our future generations.
The Stories of Xi Jinping podcast series shares the life and work experiences of Xi Jinping and explores the formation of his governing principles, philosophy, beliefs, among others. Getting to know Xi's thoughts on national governance and how his leadership took shape may help you better understand China's path, governance, and principles. You can follow the Stories of Xi Jinping podcast series on all major podcast platforms.
Deep Dive, a podcast of CGTN Radio. We go beyond headlines with reporters from around the world. Search for Deep Dive on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen. Take a deep dive into the news every week. Hear our conversations.